Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 379.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about culture, and where we look upon the legislative history of Jim Jordan and wonder, does he like legislating at all, even? I am your host, Nagin Farsad. And, is there a way we can bring back Tip O'Neill from the dead? Because he feels like the only person who can wrangle this mess of people that we have to deal with. Folks, as a professional podcaster, they tell you to silence your phones. And boop, there it is. And that's me silencing my phone. This is a really professional operation. Today, we'll talk about that political mess and the mess that universities are finding themselves in with the statement making. We'll also talk about the great therapist psychic divide. And finally, a new study finds that yelling is bad for kids, which seems obvious, but I guess it's nice to have research on it. Today, I'm joined by, oh my God, what an incredible panel. This panel, folks. First of all, we're joined first by this woman who just casually in the frame has an Emmy, just like sitting in her Zoom frame. She's not in studio with us. So we can see not only an Emmy, but like a very vintage typewriter. She is just like a decorated journalist. She was an executive producer at Vice for it long enough to win Emmys, plural. She's currently at Meteor. And it's funny because I can never keep track of where she is because she's always just on the go, on the rise, fucking killing it. She's also co-host of In Retrospect. It's called In Retrospect with Susie Bani Karim. And your other co-host, whose name I'm blanking on.
Jessica Bennett.
And she's just all around fantastic. Also, last accolade, she's Iranian. Folks, yes, come on. Does it get any better than Susie Bani Karim?
I'm going to try and live up to this introduction. I don't know if I can do it, but I'm going to try.
My goal is to have a podcast length introduction of you one day. Just 45 minutes of me introducing you. Also joining us on the show today, he's an old buddy of mine. And so we've been in weird vans in Ohio together, which sounds like we were abducted together. In some ways we were. But we've done so. He's the founder of Drinking Liberally, which is one of my favorite social mobilization organizations. He is a campaign director at MoveOn.org. That's what he's primarily known for. But he's also written books, plural. He's also a former improviser. But are you ever not an improviser? I think you're always just an improviser in life. Life is one improv game. As no one said, and he's just really smart, really funny, and knows everything about politics. It is the one and only Justin Krebs.
Yes, and I'm happy to be here today. So happy to be here with both of you as the non-Iranian, non-award-winning member of this panel.
Wait, didn't you? I feel like you won an award, a citation from the city or something.
Citations and awards, so different.
Once you arranged that I won a citation from the city of New York. Do you remember that? Anyways, do you not remember this?
What did you get the citation for?
For being a great humanitarian.
That's amazing. It's amazing.
An exceptional Iranian.
I'm like a midwife to other people's citations.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's exactly what you are. And folks, before we get into the show, I just want to remind people that they can go to patreon.com/NagineFarsad to support the show that casually brings together people like Susie Benny Kenim and Justin Krebs and all these wonderful voices that we have on the show every week. This is our 379th episode. And right now, you might be enjoying this episode of Fake the Nation. You might also be enjoying a recap episode of The Golden Bachelor, which drops on Friday. So you're getting two for one. So go to patreon.com/NagineFarsad and you can subscribe to the show and support the show, and make sure that the show keeps on living to more episodes. And also, I was formerly sick. I kind of had laryngitis or whatever. So that's why my voice sounds like a little messed up. All right, here we go. Let us get into it with topic number one. Our fearless producer checks in on the New York Post so that the rest of us don't have to. And this week he found a gem. There is a piece that is making the claim that more and more New Yorkers are opting for psychics instead of therapists. And New York sets a lot of trends, so this might be happening in your hometown soon enough. My question to both of you is, does this sound true? Have you heard of this? Is this a trend you've recognized in your among your own people? Are they going for psychics instead of therapists?
I mean, okay, this is a classic New York Post reporting exercise because they found a total of one person who has done this. They're like, one person has switched from therapy to a psychic, and so it's a trend. So that part is classic in and of itself because I don't believe that this is like sweeping the nation. But also, even the psychics in this article are like, this is not a good idea. And also, I just want to point out the third thing about this that's just classic is they're also like, most psychics are scammers. So even the psychics are not selling this concept. So, I mean, if you don't want to go to therapy, don't go to therapy. And I've been to a psychic, no shade. Like, you know, we're Iranian. We believe in mysticism.
Oh, and, for sure.
Yeah, I believe the universe has messages for us. But, you know, it's not a replacement for therapy. I think we can all agree.
In terms of whether it was true or not, I immediately went to my psychic to ask. And she said, no, it's not true. No, I was struck, similar to what you just pointed out, about the article. It seemed like most of the psychics interviewed were also white women. It was like a very particular demographic of psychic. And I don't know if it represented all psychics in New York. I don't know if it represented the people who were going to psychics. But I was struck that there was not a lot of diversity among the psychicness, given how many different cultures, as you just pointed out, would have spirituality, would believe in celestial forces, something greater than we see every day. But no, I have not heard of anybody who has quit therapy to go to a psychic. And in fact, since the pandemic, I've only heard of more and more people going to therapy, individual therapy, couples therapy, family therapy, children's therapy, parenting therapy, dog therapy, cat therapy, every sort of therapy that's out. I'm sure there's real estate therapy. We're in New York. and I would love to see more psychics getting into this realm, but I have not actually experienced that in my own life yet.
You know, I would say the one thing that I have experienced in my own life is, I mean, again, like, I'm an Iranian, so yes. Do I know people that are like, let's read your Turkish coffee grounds? Absolutely. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Tarot cards, like other forms of mediums, whatever. Yes, that happens. Also, I'm a comedian, so double whammy. Comedians love that shit. I would say the thing that I find that people are looking more and more for are people that will tell them something directly. Hmm. And therapists can't do that, right? Therapists have to like help you, shepherd you into your own realization about something. And that can be frustrating and it could take a really long time. And you just want to say to your therapist, like, fucking tell me the thing. Tell it. I know you know the thing. Tell me what it is. And so I think that is something that people may, if in fact this reporting based on a sample set of one is true, then I think what people are like yearning for is just declarative, definitive statements about their lives from the point of view of another person, which I think also is something that I get out of like brunch.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I think the other thing is, as someone who has gone to therapy for a very long time, I've kind of worn my therapist down now. So she does tell me what she thinks. Like, it took a long time, but just like, you know, if you just keep at it, eventually they just, you know, they break down and they start giving you advice. You just have to stick to it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I also think, well, the other interesting thing about this trend to me is that therapy seems to be a lot about, like, well, unless it's like cognitive behavioral therapy, which I guess is like a different approach, but more traditional therapy, and even in CBT, they like ask you about your past. And so I wonder if people are like, in this, I'm gonna just make some sweeping, crazy analyses right now. In this post-pandemic world, first of all, fucking shoot me in the face already. I hate starting sentences that way. But in this post-pandemic world, people are like, don't want to look to the past. They want to look to the future. You know what I mean? I feel like there's this thing of like that therapy is just like, what happened in your childhood? In the same way that like I can't handle watching like a TV show or something like that's set in the pandemic. I don't want to remember times. I don't want to think about it. It's over for me. Like, it, not that I understand it, it's not over. Don't at me. But like, that era of it is over. And it's like, I don't want to like stew in all those things anymore. I don't necessarily want to stew in my childhood or whatever. Like, I get that people kind of want a forward thinking future attitude, which ridiculously a psychic may provide, which is so stupid. As I say this, I feel stupid. But anyways,
But psychics have the room to be optimistic. So I think what you're saying is that one of the reasons we might also like fantasy novels, for those of us who do, or the expanded various cinematic universes, which some of us might, is because we want something beyond our reality. Our reality, if you read the news, it can be kind of depressing, can be frustrating, can be scary, can be sad, it can feel outside of our control. So if it's going to be outside of our control anyway, let's believe there's something magical that takes us beyond ourselves. And I could see that being an argument. About the post-pandemic thing, just quick note. We have a definite divide in my household. I wanted TV shows that took place in 2021, 2022 to show people in masks. And my wife absolutely did not. She was like, "We see masks in our real life. I don't want to see them on TV."
Wait, you wanted to see that?
I wanted TV shows. So This Is Us, when it came back after the pandemic break,
they had
the first episode,
stuff.
They had one mask for like 10 seconds. And I actually thought there was more plots to engage. So that counters the argument I was just making. Maybe that means I'm on the therapy side and not the psychic side,
which
isn't how our family would play out. So confusing.
Also, I mean, honestly, you're the first person I've ever met that wants to see more masks in TV shows.
I thought you were going
to
say you're the first 45-year-old dude referencing This Is Us. But we know that's not true. We know that we all reference This Is Us.
I had a This Is Us finale party.
Oh my God. I mean, I watched This Is Us, but that is next level.
Well, no. And by finale party, I mean two friends came over.
Okay. That's more normal.
I believe that one of them was a 45-year-old dude.
There you go. I feel seen.
Yeah. So we're ridiculous. Anyways, okay, folks, what do you think? Are you going to a psychic? Which, again, I have literally gone to a psychic.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, this is in no way a judgment. Mm-hmm. Also, at what Susie said at the top, they did. This article was chock full of psychics saying, "Be careful of psychics." So please be careful of psychics.
Sounds like those psychics really, really knew. Yeah. They had a psychic premonition to beware other psychics.
All right, folks, let's take a quick break so we can learn about our sponsor. And then when we come back, we'll continue our chatter. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, "What are you feeling about this Factor?" And they were like, "It is delicious. You should definitely do it." So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. And we are back and we're ready with topic number two. Okay, so at the time of this taping, it is Wednesday, early afternoon. Jim Jordan is in the process. He lost the first round of votes, right?
Is losing.
He is losing.
Well, it's the second round, right? He had a round yesterday. So yeah.
Right.
Yes. It's confusing. It's his second round because Scalise like didn't even go through a round. Is that right?
He went through one round.
I think he like they did like a this is like confusing, but and then there was another guy that like got in there because he was like, this is gross, and then he just wanted to like mess it up a little. Point is, it's confusing. There's two rounds. Jim Jordan has not won so far, but let's talk quickly about who he is and how he might have done it. I should note that he is a right-wing pro-insurrectionist.
Yeah.
And in the interest of not being all negative, I should also note that he does speak like Okay, so he's an insurrectionist, but like he strings together some nice sentences.
I don't even know where is this going.
No, because I don't. I don't want to just. I don't know. I'm trying to be nice. Anyways, I heard an interview with him, and I disliked almost everything he said. But like, I didn't think he sat. Like, I did appreciate like his conviction. Like, it feels like he believes his things. Which I, you know, but I think the things that he believes are uncool. Okay, so I also should note that he doesn't have a huge legislative track record. Mm. Kind of like no real legislative track record is, I think, a fair way of saying that. And then also,
yeah, no, I don't think he's passed a single piece of legislation.
Yes, right. That's right. I don't know why I'm being so sensitive to Jim Jordan's feelings. Do you think he would be this sensitive to my feelings?
100% no. But also, in your defense, I don't think the GOP likes Jim Jordan. Like, you are struggling to find something nice to say about Jim Jordan. They all hate him, which is why.
That's right. I don't know why. I don't know. Because I'm like, oh, he has probably a family who loves him. Okay. So anyways, his main accomplishments are actually derailing legislation, mm-hmm. which makes me feel like he's in the wrong job, like just to begin with. But what do you think about this process? It has been confusing. Scalise has sort of withdrawn his name because he's just like, even though he's like sort of favored, let's call it a moderate, Jim Jordan end up sort of barreling through like bullying tactics. Sean Hannity was involved. People were bullied publicly. I don't know. What do you guys make of this process, and what do you think is happening?
We're watching a circus on top of a meltdown, on top of a train wreck. That could still end up with Jim Jordan being the speaker. That's the absurd part of all. Everything about this is messy. From the fact that Scalise gets more votes in their caucus, and that somehow leads to Jim Jordan's bullying, making him the next likely speaker. Everything about this is screwy and messy. And yet, by the time people hear this recording, he might be the speaker. Or he might have lost, or he might have withdrawn, or they might do 15 more rounds tomorrow. And any of those is kind of equally likely, depending on what 8 or 10 vulnerable, I won't even call them moderate, vulnerable Republicans decide to do with their votes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of depressing, to be honest. I mean, there's like a world war about to start, and these guys can't get their act together. I think it's been almost 2 weeks now, right? Or maybe more than 2 weeks where they haven't had a Speaker of the House. So, I mean, in general, I think this just speaks to what's happening in the GOP, which is that, you know, the Trump wing of the party still wants to rule with an iron fist, but that's getting harder and harder. And I think this Jordan vote, the fact that he's going to go to 2 votes, and I think this Jim Jordan vote is an example of just how much disarray they're in, because, you know, he's going to lose 2 votes, and it's because everybody hates him. I mean, he's a real jerk in the House. Like, he
John
is really
Boehner
to
referred to him as a legislative terrorist, and Liz Cheney said he can't be trusted with the Constitution. So those are just 2 fun quotes from.
Yeah, I mean, he's just
GOP.
Very, very
those the positives.
Mean to his fellow House members.
Yeah.
I mean, my favorite story in all of this, because I just love like how childish and petty it seems, like how much they all seem like they're like boys in high school, like jockeying for position, is that there's a rumor that when Jim Jordan and Steve Scalise met after Steve Scalise won the first nomination, that Jim Jordan had a temper tantrum and said to him, you know, if you lose 1 round, then I'm going to run and America wants me, and stormed out of his office.
Like, I'm the eldest boy.
Right. Exactly. I'm the eldest boy. Like, it's just so funny to me that he thinks he's going to win through temper tantrum. But I think maybe that's what Trump taught these guys, that works. But it's kind of surprising to see, you know, people in the party starting to stand up to these guys. Like,
well, yeah, let's talk about that really quick. You said it's getting harder and harder for the Trumpists to rule with an iron fist. I mean, Justin, do you feel that's true, this claim that Susie is making?
I don't know. In some ways, the hard right wing, whether you call them Trumpists or not, they're the ones who derailed McCarthy, derailed Scalise, and are now supporting Jordan. So in some ways, they haven't won yet, but they're showing that they are capable of defeating others within their party. Some of it might not come down to whether Jim Jordan is qualified or not, but might actually come down to, like, at what point do other House members tire of not having a speaker? Does the House need a speaker is maybe an interesting question, but in practicality, evidently it does need a speaker if they want to do things like pass continuing resolutions to keep the government open. And you might get to a point that at a certain date, some people say, we just need that mop. That mop can be the speaker. Oh, Jim Jordan standing in front of that mop, we'll vote for him instead. Like, that's what it might come down to, is who is standing at the moment that people decide we need somebody who can hold the gavel. And it's scary that thanks to the bullying tactics, thanks to this kind of, high school jockeying, that that Jim Jordan might be the one who's standing there when folks finally decide we just need somebody to at least conduct business around here.
Is there do either of you see some sort of like glorious scenario where like there's like a wonderfully centrist person that with the help of the Democrats like gets voted in?
I don't think there's a glory scenario. It's hard to picture, but I do think there's a scenario that's being floated a lot, which is that there's this interim speaker, Patrick Henry. And
oh, yeah, that guy.
It sounds like what they're going to do, the GOP is thinking of doing, is if Jordan loses this vote and, you know, decides to go for another or doesn't, that they could actually empower him to be able to do some of the role of the speaker so that they wouldn't have so much urgency around getting a speaker in place. And that guy was appointed by Kevin McCarthy. So I think he has some stake in that. Like, that's his guy. So it sounds like that's what's happening in the background now from what I read and like Politico. I mean, so because I'm not on the Hill, so I don't really know what's happening. And I think that's actually not a bad solution.
That's not a bad solution.
That guy's kind of a moderate, and at least they could get some work done. I mean, I am very worried.
It's funny because he also doesn't want that job, which I think is, I mean, which is great because it's like he's not in it for the fucking glory. He hates that idea.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants this job who has like a, you know, who has any self-respect. I mean, they're so mean to you in this job.
Yeah.
I mean, it really gives you, I have to say, I know people are going to like, you know, at us about this, but it really does make you admire Nancy Pelosi. She ran her caucus. Like, she knew what she was doing. Whatever you feel about her or don't feel about her, she would not have overseen a mess like this. Like, this would not have happened under her watch. And I think that's something the GOP needs to figure out.
Justin, final thoughts on this?
Well, I was just thinking that that McHenry, it would be a phenomenal sort of House of Cards intrigue if the way he got to be speaker was he got himself added to the secret list by Kevin McCarthy, ousted McCarthy, defeated Scalise, defeated Jordan, convinced Republicans to change the rules of what a temporary speaker could be so that he could wield a mild gavel. And that he's, in fact, the Sith Lord behind all of this.
Right, that's some House of Cards shit.
Him and his bow tie, yeah.
That's hilarious. I like that. Let's float that theory hard so that it gets into Politico and then people start being like, this is what's happening. Okay, let's move on to another aspect of politics, which is the war is obviously still going on. The atrocities are still happening. It's really depressing. But I wanted to talk about one angle of it, which is that universities have had an interesting time with the discussion around the war in the Middle East. One student group in Harvard blamed Israel for the violence. Lawrence Summers, a former university president, also Treasury Secretary, condemned the Harvard's administration for not speaking up and making a statement. That's one example. Columbia University closed its campus to the public last Thursday because two student protests planned, on the same day. It happened also after an Israeli student was allegedly assaulted with a stick. Posed security risks, so they closed off campus. There have been clashes at Indiana University, at UNC Chapel Hill. I mean, the list goes on. It's a mess out there. And my question for the two of you is, what is a university to do? I mean, there's this question of like people like Lawrence Summers being like, there should be a definitive statement. Harvard needs to put out a statement, you know? What do you think is a university's role in a situation like this?
So I think it's complicated, right? Because they have made statements in recent years. Like, there used to be much more of a sense that these universities would stay neutral during conflicts, but you know, I think a lot of universities made statements about Ukraine. They certainly made statements during Black Lives Matter. So it's shifted the conversation a little bit. And I think the other thing that has really changed, I think, in our lifetimes is the way we talk about Palestine. Like, I think, you know, when I was in college as a Middle Eastern person, it was very clear to me that I was not really allowed to express any concern for the Palestinian people. It was very much seen as a controversial position. And that feels like it's really fundamentally shifted over the last, I'd say, 5 years. And in large part because young Jewish people have come forward and said that they see what's happening and they don't agree with it. So, you know, I think this conflict is a little more complicated by that. And so Harvard didn't want to come in and kind of condemn their Palestinian student organizations for making the statement they did. At the same time, you know, Harvard is a business. You know, it's like their endowment is $51 million. So I think what that comes down to is that those donors, for the most part, are still
billion.
Did I say million? I meant billion.
Yeah, it's billion. So inconceivable, yeah, but it is.
This is, by the way, the second time because I said Patrick Henry, and I'm pretty sure it was Patrick McHenry. So I'm doing a great job today, guys.
So good. Guys, write everything down that Susie says. It's all so accurate.
It's all fact. I'm a great journalist. This award behind me proves it. But yeah, so I mean, that those billionaire donors have a strong point of view. And I think that's why the president of Harvard had to come back and make a second statement that was stronger in defense of what, you know, of Israel's position, because, you know, at the end of the day, that money is what makes the decisions at these universities. So I feel like they should do what University of Chicago has done. They just don't take political stands. And that feels right. Like, universities should be places where students get to make their own decisions and debate and argue. I don't know. I feel like that makes more sense to me, but I don't know. I mean, I know it's complicated.
Yeah, I mean, Stanford came out with a policy stressing neutrality. Northwestern said that going forward, they would not take a position on geopolitics. Justin, what do you think of the statement, not statement? Also, full disclosure, we're with a Harvard alum, so.
I've been getting the alum emails of statement after statement sent to the Harvard alumni community. I do find it complicated because I don't think universities should stay out of politics completely. Mm. I think there's a great track record of getting universities to be on the right side of civil rights, getting universities to be on the right side of apartheid. So I you know, when I was there, there was pushes for everything from the progressive student labor movement and minimum wages and living wages for employees to getting grapes out of the cafeteria as part of solidarity with grape workers who are on strike. So there are definitely places where, the same way, as you point out, Harvard universities are businesses, the same way you would advocate as a consumer to push businesses to have certain practices, you want to push your universities. And I also think that probably the primary goal, to agree, is that the universities need to make their campuses places where students of disagreeing opinions can fully voice their opinions. So they shouldn't be suppressing protests or statements, and they shouldn't be doing or allowing what's happened at Harvard, where students have been doxxed. Granted, Harvard did not do this, but people have been running mobile billboards with the names of students who signed certain letters to publicly shame and humiliate. And so those are wealthy bullies that are separate from the university, but that should be condemned, that kind of bullying, because this is actually a place where voices can be shared, where opinions can be shared. And I do think, primarily what I would ask is, not just, if it's just about the statements, we're not getting to a depth of it. Where a university has financial interests and they can do something with that money, then you actually should be asking them to stand on some premise, on some principle with their money. The parallel I think of is that I've been seeing debates among like the PTAs of Brooklyn, where I live, of like, should our PTA make a statement? And it's like, I don't know, before or after the advertisement about the bake sale and the fun run. It's like I do think PTAs and universities and the DOE and places need to affirm the safety and the dignity of all the people within their communities. But they don't necessarily, not everyone's statement is that useful on everything, unless there's a fundamental way that they're involved. Some universities like Harvard are so big and do have a stake in it, and I do hope that they find a way to prioritize differing opinions and respect for political speech and fundamentally the safety of their students and professors and staff as well in the course of it.
That's interesting. I also wonder, like, when you were at school or when I was at school, if there was a difference between the kids, you know, because I remember we were always like marching and shit for like raising the minimum wage for like student workers or stuff like that. I don't quite remember, you know, we were protesting like how the kind of segregation that ended up happening with housing and blah 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 blah. Not like it was just sort of like natural segregation that ended up happening. The university did change their policies because of our protesting, but it was sort of like student driven mobilization that changed the university's policies versus a university making a statement from the top down. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's like a little bit of a difference there. I think like a student driven mobilization, I think that's great. I think that's good. Yeah. Like people, and I also think, and if you look at it as something like, oh, how should the endowment be invested? Okay, like I don't want it to be invested in fossil fuels, for example. And that's a political statement. And the university would have to make a political statement. So I think it's true that, like, I can see what Stanford's doing. I could see what Northwestern's doing. That makes total sense. Don't get involved, whatever. Just let students have their ideas and express them on the quad as they're playing Frisbee. But also, you are making political statements with how you operate as a university, how you invest with your endowment. I mean, there's a lot of statement making going on all the time in other ways.
I'm almost more invested in the fights, the governance fights, the mobilizations, the students that determine how things are invested and what's taught. I think some of the statement fascination and statement fatigue is because of this age of Twitter. It's like a company can make a statement by sending a tweet. You know, in the 1980s and 1990s and 2000s, like, we don't know, like, we knew if Coca-Cola was paying their workers or not if they said something in honor of National Workers Day.
Right. We didn't know if like Crest toothpaste was on the side of Ukraine or whatever, right? Yeah. Like it was, yeah. And I have to say too, just in general about everybody, you know, I feel like we don't need to ourselves as individuals feel the need or any kind of pressure to have a position. It's okay if an issue is too complex or whatever, too nuanced for you to take a position on Instagram. I yearn for the days when it was just like, oh my God, did you see this person from high school is now on Facebook? Like, let's go back to that a little bit. Like, it doesn't have to be these like just these dark, intense statements that everybody's making from like their kitchens, you know, like why?
Well, also, I think the thing that's been interesting that I've sort of seen is that people assumed if you didn't make a statement, you somehow were for the Hamas attack, which I think is just a very strange assumption. Like, I think we can all assume that the baseline is that you're not for like a horrible massacre of people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think that's an easy assumption.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think instead there's kind of this demand that everyone contribute to the noise. And I agree. I don't think that noise is useful. It's certainly not useful in a situation like this where there's a lot of complication and nuance. But, you know, I think you guys have like convinced me. I agree now. I think universities should be more involved. Why aren't they standing on the right side of history? God damn it. I've been wrong so much today. It's really
so much. Guys, do not write down anything Susie says. She has no idea what she's talking about.
But definitely listen to my podcast. My opinions there are
amazing. In retrospect. Subscribe. All right, folks, let me know what you think. And in the meantime, we will move on to topic number three. So a new study finds that shouting at, denigrating, or verbally threatening children can be as damaging to their development as sexual or physical abuse. Now, this is a little bit of an obviously, but I was a little bit surprised that shouting can carry the same developmental issue, can have the same kind of developmental damage as other forms of abuse. Was that surprising to either of you?
If by surprising, as a fellow parent of small children, you mean I really don't want that to be true, then yes, I was quite surprised and a little bit in denial of that. No, it obviously makes sense to me that verbal abuse is a serious matter. I kept rereading that article to assure myself, to assuage my guilt, that the periodic shouting and verbal abuse are different somewhere.
Different,
which this article was not long enough to get into, but I 100% believe that that verbal abuse is terrible. Let me be on the record. Let me make my statement on that. my university does the same. But it is hard. It is hard to sometimes shout to be heard because they're so loud and they're such bad listeners.
They're so loud. And they don't want to do anything that is right in the moment.
No, never.
You know what I mean? And they're very hell-bent on destruction. It's they're little like rogue nations and it's tough.
And for what it's worth, I then recognize with some humility and shame that shouting didn't help anything.
Yeah.
It clearly doesn't. And yet sometimes it's just the only way to make a goddamn point.
Yeah. I mean,
not proud of it.
I think to be fair to me and Justin, who now seem like we're just verbal abusers, is that how we're painting ourselves?
Only to children.
You're pro verbal abuse. Okay, I understand.
No, and I mean like okay, like and you've both like seen me with my kid. Like I think the verbal abuse in this is probably in the study is a different level of like, can you just pick up your Legos for the 14th time or whatever? Like, I think it's different. I mean, and also like there's been a couple of times where I've yelled and then I've had to do a pull aside with my daughter and be like, listen, I shouldn't have yelled like that. I'm really sorry. And, you know, because they say, as I talked to my therapist about this.
Back to therapy.
I talked to my psychic about this. And what the tarot card said was that what you should do is if you do have like a yelling event, because every parent does, you then immediately mend it. Like, don't wait or whatever. It's like the not mend. I mean, don't yell and mend constantly because that's not good. But if you yell, let's say you're doing a once every couple of months yell. You yell and then you mend and you're just like, I'm really sorry. Like, I that was a difficult situation for me and I lost my temper and like I didn't, and that was not good. I don't want to do that. I'm really sorry, whatever. And parents make mistakes and all that shit, you know? So, that's, I think, yeah. And I have to say, like, as a playground parent, I will see occasionally, very seldomly actually, a parent yell at their kid and I feel horrible. Like, just to hear it in the vicinity, you know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, is that what that sounds like? It's fucking horrible, you know? I don't know. Yeah. Susie, where do you stand?
I mean, I'm going to do what parents love, which is, as someone who doesn't have kids, I'm going to give you my opinions on
yes,
like to raise
yes.
children. Parents will love this.
Yes.
And
experience.
Then also tell us how awesome your nightlife is.
Yeah, my life is amazing. I mean, I do have a dog, so it's basically parenting right now. I know that's not true. I mean, I had the exact same reaction to this piece. I was like, what's the line exactly? Like, where does it go from just like a little frustration to verbal abuse? Like, it feels like, I don't know. I mean, again, like, we're Iranian, like, we're just loud talkers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, what counts is shouting? But I think your psychic/therapist is right about this. Like, I think people do lose their temper or they get frustrated. And part of what you want to teach your children is how to cope when that happens, right? So that they see that when you do that, you respond to it in a healthy way. You apologize or you process it with them as opposed to just like shout verbal abuse at them, like berate them and then be like, you're the worst and I hate you and leave, right? I mean, that's obviously, I think we know the difference between those two things. So I think modeling like healthy coping mechanisms with your feelings is not the worst thing in the world. But again, I'm not a parent, so I feel like my opinions about this should come with an asterisk, which is I'm like, it's great. Like, I'm an aunt. I get to like come hang out with your kids. I'm super fun. I spoil them and then I get to go away. So even if I'm terrible, you know, nobody really remembers.
Answer the best. I do think that another technique that I know about is sort of if you shout and you lose, you're basically throwing a tantrum as well as a grown up. Sometimes in some of these cases. And the same way that maybe if a child who has a tantrum, you give them a timeout, it's not even necessarily punishment. It's a way for them to remove themselves from the situation, be someplace that is safe, let the storm pass. You as a grown-up can take your own timeout. It's not the kid's place to tell you to take a timeout, but you could be like, I need to go to my other room right now.
Yeah.
And then you come back. So you're modeling actually that a timeout isn't a stigma. It's something that we all need. And Susie, as a new dog owner, I'm very new to this.
Yes,
I'm actually seeing some of the same parallels. I 100% shout at my dog sometimes. And then I'll see other people shouting at their dogs. I'll be like, dude, the dog doesn't understand what you're saying. This is absurd. Why are you shouting at your dog? And I'm like, oh, that's what I look like when I shout at my dog or my kids. They're like, there are parallels here that I think are quite apt. But as somebody who's only had a dog for like 4 weeks,
also,
you can judge me.
I also think,
oh my God, 4 weeks in on a dog, I just want you to tell you, it gets better.
Well, the funny thing is they don't sleep through the night. The funny thing is, right? Like at four, when they're little, I remember.
And also,
my
they
dog
just pee everywhere in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
They need constant attention. They chill out.
This is similar to children.
totally. But I want to say, just in terms of the shout, one thing that did make me feel better is, my shouting is really like situation based. So it is literally like, please put on the socks, like the socks, you have to put on the socks. And then my the volume of me saying that goes up, but it's still about socks. The shouting that they're talking about in the study is really about like insults, put downs, and name calling, which I think we probably don't
do. We can all agree.
Like that is, and again, like I have heard that on the playground. It just this one time I heard it so like intensely. And I can't even forget it. Like this one time, like 2 years ago, I heard a man yell at his child in a way that just felt so horrible. And it was just such a wake up call because there was name calling. There was insulting, you know? And it was like, oh God, that 5 year old does not deserve that, you know? And it felt very clear at that moment.
You are the collateral trauma damage of that person's verbal abuse.
Yeah, right? Like exactly.
If you're carrying it, imagine
smoke.
That kid.
Yeah, exactly. If I'm carrying this fucking one memory, like it scarred me as a witness, imagine what it's doing to that kid. Therefore, this now WHO study is real and it is true. Susie, write it down.
All right, I'm putting it down.
All right, folks, that is the end of the show. And what a wonderful show it was. What a delight that I got to speak to both of you on the same day at the same time. It's so wonderful. And what I want is for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the wonderful works that you do. Justin Krebs, where do they do that?
Oof. You can check out drinkingliberally.org, which is a national network of political happy hours, and you can find one near you. Or you can take action at moveon.org, where I'm not speaking on behalf of Move On today, but where I do a lot of my political work.
And by the way, Justin Krebs is one of the first people that introduced me to the works of Robert Putnam, from which Drinking Liberally was birthed, I would say, is the philosophical backdrop of that organization. And in terms of like building social capital and making it fun, like politics should be more fun, and you should be able to find people and have a drink and have a laugh and have a chat while mobilizing. And, you know, people on the show have heard me say this over and over again, but I really believe in that. So definitely look up Drinking Liberally. There might be a Drinking Liberally chapter in your town that you can join. And I've been to Drinking Liberallys around the country and they're so fun. So join. It's just a really great way to be active and have a good time while you're doing it. Susie, where do they find you? Susie Bani Karim.
You can find me on Instagram at SusieBNYC because I signed up for that account when I was like, you know, a young baby. And also, please listen to In Retrospect with Susie Bani Karim and Jessica Bennett. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. And, you know, if you don't want to listen, but you just want to give it a 5-star rating, we will not object to that. We will not be mad at that. But please do listen. It would mean a lot to us. We just started, so there's just a few episodes out. It's not a big commitment, guys. It's fun.
Oh, my gosh. And I don't know her personally, but I know the work of Jessica Bennett, these two women together, this podcast. It is definitely a must subscribe. So don't forget, In Retrospect, subscribe, enjoy, rate, review, do all the things. Let's make sure this podcast gets a nice, healthy audience. All right. And you know where to find me and all the things that I do. do this weekend. I'll be at the Kennedy Center. And then I also have dates in Philadelphia. I'm going to be at the Reston Community Center doing my full hour. So if you're in Virginia, anywhere in Virginia, I think it's just like maybe a 4 or 5 hour drive from the furthest point of Virginia. Come to Reston and see me do my full hour. Otherwise, I want to thank all the people that make our show a possibility. That's our wonderful producer, Andrew McGuire. Thanks to Gabby Alter for our theme music. Thanks to everyone at HeadGum for making the show a possibility. If you have any ideas, questions, concerns, you can email us at faiththenationpodcast@gmail.com. And you can hear The Golden Bachelor on Friday, Golden Bachelor Recaps. Oh my God, he's a silver fox and he's looking for love. It's such a fun and ridiculous show. So join us on Friday for that. And otherwise, we will be in your earballs on Friday.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.